Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be rejoined today by Chris Yogerst, who has been on the show two times before. We had him on to talk about his book, Hollywood Hates Hitler, and his history of the Warner Brothers, called The Warner Brothers. Very exciting stuff. We are here today to talk about his new book for the Real West series out of the University of New Mexico Press. The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance is what we are discussing today. A nice little study of that in paperback, fits right in your pocket form. It's really, really handy. Chris, thank you for being back on the show today.
Thank you for having me again. This is always a blast.
I want to pull up your book here, because I just want to read something from near the end of your book here. The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, quote, represents everything that historians and critics have mined from its story, but the film can also transcend all of it. The film is about America. It is about how we tell stories, and the emotion in the film expands well beyond the genre. Sometimes the legend is no longer worth printing, end quote, which of course is a reference to kind of the most famous line in the book. I want to discuss this movie as kind of a synecdoche for westward American expansion, America itself, the idea of America, the way that stories are told about America, the way the movie industry tells stories about America. But before we get to any of that, what was it about The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance that made you say, I'm going to sit down and write a whole book about it?
Well, it started actually the series editor of this long before he was the series editor, Andrew Patrick Nelson, who is an authority on Westerns. I had mentioned that this was one of my favorite Westerns, and I was expecting to like, oh yeah, I love that too. But he gave me really that one? That's one? I got the exact same response from Kevin Brownlow, of all people. And once the series became a thing, Andrew was like, you need to prove to all of us why this movie is as great as you say it is. So I decided to write the book. But the reason the movie has stuck with me has everything to do with that famous line, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend. And this idea of printing legends, and that's kind of what we do. Sometimes we can find a better story than what really happened, or we think there's a better story than what really happened. And when you start getting into, the more I got into studying history and film history, the more I came across legends and lies and stories and trying to find the facts, this line kept coming back to me in my mind that there is something about printing the legend. And sometimes printing the legend is fun. It can make for really good stories. But at the same time, we should also know what's really going on or what really happened, right? I mean, and the Western is a perfect place for this, because there's been, by the time this movie came out, there was nearly a century of legends about people, heroes and villains in the Old West that historians had been then kind of parsing through and still are trying to figure out, was this true? Did this really happen in Deadwood, or who was all there? These kinds of things. And so I think it's something that it's just stuck with me. And I just wanted to spend more time thinking about this film and just kind of put it out there and see if anyone else also liked this movie the same way I do.
Yeah. The idea of the Western as sort of the American myth making, the frontier, the legendary thing has always been a part of the Westerns I most care for. I mean, Unforgiven, of course, is very much a movie, both a movie about deconstructing the idea of the Western and, you know, Clint Eastwood kind of famously playing the sort of role he played and showing it's not all it's cracked up to be, et cetera, et cetera. But it is also just within the text of the film itself, very much a movie about the legends that people craft for themselves. I mean, this is the whole point of Gene Hackman's character in that film. And then you get it elsewhere too. You know, one of the kind of interesting meta things that happened was the kind of co-debuts of Tombstone and Wyatt Earp, which are, you know, you have like, that's kind of, Tombstone is kind of the legend of the OK right. Corral, and Kevin Costner's Wyatt Earp is more like, okay, here's the messy reality of Wyatt Earp, the person. And then, you know, even stuff like The Quick and the Dead, right? The Quick and the Dead is very much about, you know, the gunmen, the gunslingers, the shootists who are called out to do battle with, again, Gene Hackman, interestingly enough, all have their own little stories they tell about mm-hmm. themselves. And this is kind of the movie where that subtext is made text. I mean, it is
absolutely
the close of the film. What is it? What? Why was it so fitting for John Ford and John Wayne to be the guys to break that line out into the world? I mean, John Wayne does not deliver the line in the film, obviously, but he is very much the legend of the West as we kind of understand it from the early to mid 20th century.
Right. Well, and I'm glad you mentioned Unforgiven. I mean, that's a perfect, more contemporary companion to this movie that really just shows, like, it just unveils the reality behind the legend, right? Like, these kinds of gunfighters aren't cool. They're not heroic. And in fact, maybe a lot of them, if not all of them, are bad people, right? Like, there's a lot of, you know, and the heroes aren't exactly who we think they are either. Right, you have the Hackman in there, right? And there's so many great lines in that movie. And then you even have the writer in there, right? That's trying to write the legend in that movie. Right. And in this one, I mean, in 1962, the studio system is crumbling, if not pretty much gone. John Ford doesn't have the sway that he used to. He really needed John Wayne to make this movie. We needed that name in there. You know, it also helped to have, you know, Jimmy Stewart and then Miles and this great, you know, ensemble cast of people. But when you look at Wayne and Ford, I mean, these were two people. They didn't create the Western, but in a lot of ways they perfected it. They perfected its A game in Hollywood in a lot of ways, right? You know, a lot of people look at Stagecoach as like, this is kind of solidifying this kind of movie as an A movie. Launching John Wayne's star, launching Ford into the next level of his career, right? He was already an established director. But they had presided over so much of the genre, either together or separately, that to have both of them presiding over this kind of death, in a way, of the genre or of its current form of the, you know, the golden age version of the genre, was really kind of perfect and poetic. And I can't imagine this movie having the same impact without either of them.
Yeah. Well, let's for people who have not seen The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, and I myself hadn't seen it for a long time. So I went out and just bought the 4K and watched it this week. It was great. It looks great on 4K. It's one of those, you know, it's shot on film. It holds up very well. Why don't you remind folks the plot of The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, just so we know,
sure.
So they can remember what we're talking
right.
about.
Right. So Jimmy Stewart plays Ransom Stoddard, who is a guy. The whole movie is kind of in flashback, and we see how he became known as the man who shot Liberty Valance, and of course, he didn't shoot Liberty Valance, but that's the legend. And you have the senator who comes, or he was just a law student or a law graduate, comes out west, wants to open up wants to bring progress out west, and he wants to open up a law firm. And on the way into town, his stagecoach is robbed by Liberty Valance, And he realizes that he's got this conundrum of, well, what happens if we want to continue progress and enact laws, and there are people who will not follow these laws, and I am not the kind of guy who will just push this liberty valance out of the way. I need somebody like Tom Donovan, who played by Jimmy Stewart, who is that classic Westerner. Played by John Wayne, right? The classic Western, the kind of character he has played in a million other movies, where he's this tough guy that is on the side of civilization in the sense where he's going to keep the bad guys out of town, but he absolutely loves being that guy that has to do that. So we're at a point near the turn of the century where it's the kind of the last piece of that trajectory of that Western gunfighter character. They're going to get rid of, they're needed to get rid of the rest of these bullies on the frontier. But once they're gone, we also don't need that so-called heroic gunfighter either. So in a way, it's a death of the old West. It's a movie about the passage of time. And of course, the bitter irony of all of it is that John Wayne becomes a senator and has this big successful career because everyone believes he's the man who shot Liberty Valance, when in fact it was not.
Jimmy Stewart. That's Jimmy. I do this all the time. But it is fascinating. It is fascinating to think of it again as kind of a synecdoche for the idea of America itself, where you have this westward expansion and you have the people in wagons going, and you've got this untamed wilderness, and you have conflict with indigenous tribes, and you have conflict with other nations, and then the railroad comes in, and then everybody else comes in, and it kind of settles. And this movie does a really good job of dramatizing that moment where the old ways, the old roughneck ways, cede to civilization in a really profound way. I found myself, I was moved near tears this time, which I was kind of surprised by, because again, I've seen the movie before, but I don't think the sacrifice that Donovan makes on behalf of everyone else, on behalf of civilization, had really resonated with me the first time around.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons this movie has stayed with me, because I feel like as we age and we live more life, this movie becomes more profound. And I saw it probably the first time in my early 20s, and it's like, oh, it's interesting and it's poetic and it's all these things. But I feel like as time has passed, the movie has become more important. And I feel like the closer we get to the age of like John Ford or the characters depicted in the movie, we can understand the significance of time past, which is what Ford is kind of eulogizing in a way. But at the same time, it's when you live through major periods of change, we see, some things go away forever. And this is there's some people write about this movie and they look at it as like Tom Donovan, John Wayne, I'm going to get it right this time, loses the girl, right? And the girl mm-hmm. goes with progress and all this kind of stuff. But it's also bigger than that. I mean, he, towards the end of the movie, we see him kind of lose it, and he burns down part of his house and all this kind of stuff. And it's not just throwing a fit because he lost a girl. It's bigger than that, right? It's like he is no longer needed in this world. Like there is that kind of significance to it, where it's like everything he has defined himself as, you know, this, like you said, this roughneck, this tough guy that the town needs. He just has to go back to just being some guy. And that breaks him. And that's something that is moving, right? And it's like he understood that's he didn't like it, but he understood that that's what was necessary for society to move forward, right? And he was okay with Valance going away, but that also mean he needed to as well.
let's talk a little bit about Liberty Valance himself, because he's the title character of the film. Interestingly, this is a movie with three title characters, really. There is the man who actually shot Liberty Valance, the man who is presumed to have shot Liberty Valance, and then Liberty Valance himself. All three of the kind of ideals of the West and civilization that we're discussing here. But Liberty Valance himself is played by Lee Marvin, who is just wicked in a way that is, I don't know. I guess you kind of expect from Lee Marvin at this point in his career, but is so good and so, I don't know. What was it about that role that was so magnetic, both for him and for others at the time?
Well, one of the things I found out while I was researching this is that he really didn't think he was going to get this role. And if I remember correctly, I mean, when he would test for it, I mean, he didn't think he was going to, I mean, so he just kind of laid it all out there. Like, I'm just going to have fun with this. And it was so incredible. Right. And he had played some villains before. Here's a guy also, this is a post-war movie in a sense, where here's a guy who was in the service and probably saw some awful things, was hardened by that. Not unlike Jimmy Stewart. He plays such a nasty villain that it's almost the only villain that you could see defeating John Wayne, right? Like, we see so many John Wayne, and I think that's one of the things that makes, I've talked about this in classes before, like, what makes, like, the Joker such a great villain for Batman is because, like, you could envision that the Joker winning, right? Especially the more sadistic ones, like the Heath Ledger, right? It's like, that is a nasty dude. Batman's really got his work cut out. And it's like that, we have our whole life growing up watching Batman movies and expecting Batman to prevail. And it's like the similar kind of thing with John Wayne. There's decades and decades of him being the hero, the tough guy. He always prevails and all this kind of stuff. And Lee Marvin, when we first see him rob the stagecoach and whip Jimmy Stewart and throw his books at him, and he's just so nasty that it's, you buy it. I mean, you're terrified by this guy, and you don't fully think that John Wayne, with all of his iconic swagger and history of winning forever in movies, that this is the match for him.
Let's talk about the kind of central conflict in this film between society and civilization, because I think it is interesting that, one of the big things that Jimmy Stewart's character Rance does is he sets up a school, not because he came there to be the school teacher and the school principal, but because he gets there and he finds out most of the people can't read, and thinks that means they can't be good citizens. They can't be good citizens. If you don't understand the things in the newspaper, if you don't understand what the Constitution says, you cannot be a good citizen. And, this is not a thing that Tom Donovan, that the John Wayne character, has much use for. But it is the real heart of the conflict here. It is the heart of what is the change that is coming to the West.
It is, absolutely. And that's because your John Wayne character and your Lee Marvin character, they live by the gun, right? Like that, they live by brute force. But Jimmy Stewart knows, the Ransom Stoddard character knows, that in order for his vision of the future to be successful, that people need to be participants in that society. So in order for them to be a part of maybe the local government, things like that, they need to know how to read. And then when you know how to read, it's you can understand ideas and you can share ideas, and right, they've got the local paper there. And it's something that that's an impressive part of his dedication, because he came there as a lawyer, but now all of a sudden he opens this school and he sees how proud people become once they can take ownership of this knowledge in new ways. And of course, there's some really important visuals in that section where you have, Woody Strode talking about the Constitution and about, he's learning to read, right? And he hears this black guy in Reconstruction America standing in front of a picture of Lincoln, right? Like, that's, none of that is on accident. So I think there's a big part of the heart of this movie takes place in that classroom scene. And of course, John Wayne comes in eventually, and, you know, his whole attitude is like, we don't have time for any of this kind of stuff. But of course, that's when you see Vera Miles and everyone in there like smiling when they're finally, you know, there's like a sense of pride that they didn't know existed in learning, just the ability to learn in these new ways, is really some of the first seeds we see in the movie of like progress is starting to take over.
It's a very political film, but it's not, it's political in a way that is kind of understated. I mean, the big conflict in this movie really is between the kind of landed, or the cattle herders, the big cattle herders, the big ranchers who want the territory to remain a territory, that don't want it to become a state, and the people who want the protection of statehood to kind of stop some of the depredations that are happening to them. But it's not really. They don't lean into that so much, which is kind of surprising. I feel like if you make this movie today, there's a 15-minute lecture from somebody on, you know, the importance of, you know, solidarity and the working class, and et cetera, et cetera. But it's all right there, which is really interesting, particularly, you know, kind of given the kind of conceptions of John Ford and John Wayne's politics.
Right. You're right. That's a good way to put this. I mean, it's a very political film, but it's not political in the like contemporary left right, you know, even at the time, you know, because that, I mean, there was a lot of tensions at the time. I mean, the civil rights, you've got the Birchers, you've got a lot of stuff going on. And the closest we get to that is really just Woody Strode and Lincoln. But the movie is, I mean, really, there's a great scene in there too that's just almost like a defense of free elections, right? Where you have, you know, there's the election coming up, and then you've got Liberty Valance sitting there trying to intimidate all the voters, right? All this kind of stuff. And what Rance wants is more people involved and more people realizing what's going on. And so it's a little bit more abstract, where and I think that's what helps it age so well too, is that it's not bogged down in the politics of the late 1800s, or it's not bogged down or time stamped anyway in the politics of the 1960s. It's a lot more timeless because it's about the institution, the institutions of law, the institutions of government, the institutions or the ideas or ideals rather of just public awareness I guess what's the way to think about it is just like active citizenry, right? I mean, just being aware of what's going on and knowing that you can actually be a part of it if you want to. And one part of that is voting.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time, and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is, again, it's just kind of, it's interestingly subtle. There's a version of this movie where we get a scene where, you know, Liberty Valance himself is sitting down with the cattle ranchers, and they're like, well, what are you going to do to, you know, dissuade them. And he's like, I'm going to kill them all. I'm going to burn their houses down. And, you know, but we don't get that. We don't need that. It's a more subtle picture than that. So let's talk a little bit about the actual writing of this book, because it is, I'm always kind of fascinated by the archival research process. Let me just ask. So when you're discussing writing this book with your editor at the University of New Mexico Press, are you then like, all right, well, here's what I'm gonna have to do. I'm gonna have to go to the John Ford papers. Like, what's that process? What's the actual research process for this movie like?
The process with this one was actually relatively easy. Like, for Warner Brothers, I spent a lot of time at the archives in Los Angeles, and for Hollywood Hates Hitler, there's the National Archives in DC, so you're like going places. A lot of what I needed for this book was either online or at the University of Indiana, and I was doing a lot of the research for this during the pandemic and the years after, right after the pandemic, and they had started just scanning a lot of stuff and sending it. So I just basically had to get approval from Dan Ford to access the archival material, just tell him what my project was. And just basically, mm-hmm. I come from a place of admiration and then get the green light and then basically just look through. And they scanned a bunch of, a lot of production files for me. I got the original script and, a lot of images and things like that. And then you just spend the time looking through the production files. I mean, one of the things I was very curious about was, where was this shot? Because, right, like it looks like a TV Western, right? And a lot of it was shot just in the studio lots, and some of the exteriors, the very minimum exteriors were actually shot in the back lot at MGM. So as I was able to get all those details, but then also I was able to get the details of like how difficult this was for John Ford to make. He had to find a lot of financing himself and do it almost like a lot of projects are made today, where somebody puts together a package of stars and script and like all this stuff and funding, and then going to the studio and saying, look, I have everything together. Will you just, distribute this for me? And he pretty much had to do that, which is wild, because of course, John Ford is one of the names synonymous with just like major Hollywood director. And so this movie was a really a pain for him to get off the ground. But he did. And in a big way, it was because John Wayne attached himself to it. And John Wayne was still a major star in 1962. So, but a lot of the archival research, I mean, luckily this is just one film, so I could just focus on, the production of it, then look at the reception of it. What did people say at the time? What have historians said about it since? I was able to go and do a little more research on Dorothy Johnson, who wrote the original stories, short stories. So, I mean, they've added a lot in this movie from that. But it gave me a lot of interesting avenues to look at the movie. So this book is a little bit different than some of my other ones, where there's, a bigger scope of time and you have to look at a bigger range of archival stuff. This was really just like a few boxes of stuff and like one movie, which made it fun to be able to slow down a little bit and just kind of like marinate in the ideas of this one movie a little bit more. And that's one of the reasons why I ended the book towards the end, this chapter about the mythology of the Western, because for years I had been teaching this class, co-teaching with a philosopher, this class about pop culture and philosophy. And we used a lot of Joseph Campbell's mythology, and a lot of my part of that class was showing how that mythology was applied to famous movies. And, we talked a lot of Indiana Jones, right? George Lucas has used Campbell before. So like your Star Wars, Skywalker, all this kind of stuff, but you can see it, this kind of stuff in iconic characters like the Western hero. So I was able to play around with that a little bit more as well and look at the hero's journey side of this. Because we've got, multiple versions of heroes in here, right? You've got the kind of the changing of the guard of heroes in this movie. You had the old time Western hero and then kind of the modern era hero, which is a little bit different. So this whole movie is a big part of this movie is the changing of the guard. So yeah, it's been a mix of looking at archival materials and as well as just reading what people have said about it.
Yeah. I, uh, Could you talk a little bit about the author of the original short? Because I did not know anything about her. Learning about her in the course of reading this was really interesting to me. I am not super familiar with Western writers as a rule. What the writers of Westerns as a rule, but I was pretty interested. What was her deal?
Yeah, and same. Like, I am not, you know, and that's one big difference between me and Andrew, who's the editor here. I mean, a lot of these people that are like really know the West and the Western, they also know these Western fiction writers really well. And that's a huge blind spot for me. So I had to do a little bit more research on her. But she's a really fascinating figure because Dorothy Johnson, you know, spent some time like in the Midwest and then out in New York. And she's... It is interesting because the Western, as you know, on and off has this reputation of being kind of like a boys club. And it's like it's the place of the, you know, where the macho men hang out. But the more Westerns you watch, the sooner you realize that that's not really the case. Like, there's so much variation in this genre. And she's a perfect example of this because here's this kind of like... tiny, unassuming woman who everybody who has written about her explains that she was so insanely intimidating and badass in person. And that's where all of these ideas for these stories came out. And she grew up early in life out west. And where, not unlike John Ford, you're growing up in an era where, of course, John Ford is from out east, but you're growing up in an era where these legends from the old West were not that old, right? And you're hearing them from people who were either there or heard from someone who was there, or like the proximity to that time doesn't feel as ancient as it does now. So she really, really mined that personal experience in the way she crafted her stories. And it's made me want to read more of her work because it seems to translate into movies really well. And she wrote The Hanging Tree, which was Gary Cooper's last movie, and a number of her other Westerns have been made into movies. But she, this was just kind of a, you know, I think that this story, even though it was a short story, and Ford and his writers have expanded on the ideas of it, I feel like this story was very similar to her in terms of trying to make sense of the changing of times. Because especially if you're growing up in the West and you're still seeing, she describes in some of her interviews, just still seeing like a police station with like a horse stable on it and things like that. And it's like seeing that with your own eyes and then going to New York City and seeing like the new society kind of, you know, what the 20th century has to bring. And seeing the conflict of those two images in your mind, it's going to create some interesting emotions. And I think that's what really helped create the idea of this story that Ford and everyone else involved were able to bring and make it even grander.
Yeah. Yeah. Just one more question. And you're not the editor of the series, so I don't feel free to feel free to pass on this. But I'm curious what else is in this series, because I love these little collections where it's like, here's a series of books on a topic, here's a series of books on, you know, a filmmaker, or whatever. I love it when there's a kind of unity of ideas. So what else is in the Real West series?
Well, I got a couple of them here. So Kirk Ellis did Ride Lonesome. Susan Collin did Thelma and Louise. So that it's, you know, it's Westerns, yeah, and like the idea of the West, right? Mm-hmm. So road film there. Alan Rohde did Blood on the Moon. I know that they have Lone Star coming out, which is another modern film.
Yeah.
True Grit, the original True Grit, will be coming out. Another one just came out on Broken Arrow.
The John Travolta.
No.
Oh, that's too bad.
I know. I wish.
Yeah, I'm kidding, of course. The Lone Star is a great one. That's John Sayles, right? It just came out recently on the Criterion Collection. Yeah, I think I
picked that up. I still need to watch it.
Yeah, it's but that's a good one. And I it's funny, I watched it for the first time recently, I don't know, in the last year or so here. And I remember like being kind of hesitant because I feel like, oh, you know, it's going to be kind of it's very funny, and it's very funny is the wrong word. It's wry in its own way, and it's just really it is really 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 well done, and really a nice little portrait of people in time. People in flux, a time in flux.
Well, and that's probably why it fits in the series, because it's, I mean, the West, even the old Westerns, I mean, they're all about people in interesting points of their life, because it was an interesting point in history as well, right? For varying reasons. So yeah. You can have Westerns that take place during the standard Old West, Wild West, whatever we want to call it, but we can... you know, we could even look at our, you know, the last 20 years as an interesting, you know, with the onset of the, you know, the digital revolution and how everything has changed, you know, from, especially like in our age group, you know, from when we were kids to now, and you know, what our kids might be, you know, living through. I mean, these huge transformative eras, and this idea of just a frontier, whatever that is, right? Like we, you know, that sometimes they call, you know, sci-fi movies space western. Right, because there's, you know, there's always another like final frontier, and it's a great genre, and I think it never really dies, because it can just tackle the unknown in interesting ways. I mean, what we don't know about our future, what we don't understand about our past. I mean, the we don't understand about our present. I mean, even something like, you know, the Sheridan verse, right? You know, from Yellowstone to Landman gives us some interesting ideas just about what the kind of Western ethos means today.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was pretty much everything I'd wanted to ask. What did we not discuss about The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, either the movie or your book, or anything else about the West and the Western that you think we should have talked about for the folks to hear about?
One thing I did find interesting for my book, this goes back to what I said, like this assumption that the genre is like this boys club, is that when I was looking at how the genre was seen at the time it came out and how it's evolved, two of the biggest proponents, not only of Westerns, but of John Wayne, were Molly Haskell and Joan Didion. Mm-hmm. So you've got these two kind of, you know, coastal elite women writers that are part of this kind of upsurge of feminist thinking that can't help but love John Wayne. And they are both very conscious of the conflict that creates in their mind. More importantly, or I guess more importantly for other people, the conflict it creates in these like elite society. And there was something that they've both written very eloquently about how John Wayne was in person, was very different from his persona, including the persona that is in a lot of his last interviews that people like to take out and weaponize and that are justifiably awful, right? Everyone has read that or heard the Playboy interview from the 70s where it's like, yeah, there's no defending that. But they really add some interesting context for people who, and I've ran into people when I was writing this book that I don't watch Westerns, right? I especially don't watch Westerns with John Wayne. It's like, well, first of all, read Scott Eyman's book on John Wayne, and you'll realize that John Wayne, the person, was very different than John Wayne, the personality and the star and all this kind of stuff. But I think the things that I enjoyed most about writing this book were learning about Dorothy Johnson, and then as well as seeing how that then also tracks with Joe Dinian and Molly Haskell kind of championing the genre in an era where it was getting a lot of flack from the coastal elite. And of course, in the 60s and late in the 70s, we get so many great Westerns as well that are similar to like Unforgiven, right? You get we have these Westerns that kind of turn the genre upside down in ways. I mean, everything from like Little Big Man and McCabe and Mrs. Miller and like all this kind of stuff. And right, we've got Eastwood on the rise, and then eventually, you know, sets the stage for him to make Unforgiven. And I think a lot of these Westerns that came after that really do interesting things with the genre, in a sense, owe a debt to the Man Who Shot Liberty Valance because it was the first really big Western. Of course, you know, the genre nerds will say, well, Shane did this on a certain level. But the Man Who Shot Liberty Valance really kind of puts all the cards on the table about the West and what we feel about the past. And it forces us to confront ideas in interesting ways. And I think that a lot of the Westerns that came after this, it was almost like when John Ford and John Wayne put this movie out, it gave people a go ahead to just, you know, we've closed the classic part of this genre. So now go remake it. Learning what we've learned.
Well, and it's interesting too, you mentioned this in your book, you write about this in your book, is that around this time, not long after this movie is made, maybe even slightly before, the French critics are rediscovering John Ford, are basically championing John Ford as like the auteur, the auteur of auteur theory, more or less. I mean, not, you know, there are others in there as well. But Ford himself is very much a subject of fascination with these guys, and gets, you know, I think to the extent that his reputation needed rehabilitation, you know, which we could always discuss whether or not that's even a thing. You know, the Man Who Shot Liberty Valance and the films that preceded, I mean, basically stagecoach through the Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Their reappraisal owes a lot to that set of critics.
For sure. Yeah. By the late 50s, there's a lot of these French critics and some of them are filmmakers as well. Right. They're fascinated with Hollywood and the major directors. I mean, people like Hitchcock are part of their interest as well. And it really hits the United States with Andrew Saris, who's obviously a major critic, married to Molly Haskell. He was huge on the auteur theory and he was also big on the Western. And that's one thing I put in my book too. There was kind of that rivalry between Saris and Pauline Kael, and Pauline Kael saw genre films as really trashy. But a lot of the French critics, and people in the States like Saris didn't agree. And there was, even though, by the time the Western came out, by the time the Man Who Shot Liberty Valance came out, Westerns were kind of tired. There was a ton of them on TV. A lot of reviews started to like disparagingly refer to Westerns as horse operas. And there's kind of a slow buildup. I mean, right around when like Peter Bogdanovich starts interviewing Ford, and you've got this trendy young filmmaker interested in these old greats, right? And he creates kind of a reappraisal of Ford and Wells and Hawks and all of these people that he's talking to. This movie tracks with all of that in interesting ways because what happens after this movie is kind of a reappraisal of the Western. And that's what this movie is about on a certain level.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's just an interesting little, the whole story in miniature in this film. All right, Chris, thank you for being on today. Again, the name of the book is just The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, The Real West Series, University of New Mexico Press. You can find it on their website. You can find it on Amazon or bookshop.com. So check it out if you are into Westerns or into The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. And again, I picked up the movie on disc to prepare for this. It really does look fantastic. If you're into watching movies that look good, this is and it is interesting. You mentioned this briefly. I'm sorry, I'm getting sidetracked here, but you mentioned this briefly. But the fact that it is shot on studio backlots and not in Monument Valley, not in the kind of legendary environs that John Ford was known to inhabit, is another kind of way of breaking down that myth making to say these things were maybe smaller than we have been portraying here. But again, just an interesting little thing.
Yeah, the setting is just as much of a character in this as it is in his Monument Valley movies, but it's just we don't have Monument Valley.
Yeah. Chris, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
And we will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. Talk to you then.
Time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.